You cannot heal a body if you do not heal the planet, the plants, the animals.
If someone had a cancer diagnosis today, what would you tell them to do tonight?
First, I'd tell them to...
Because Alia Turner went and studied 10,000 of these spontaneous remissions and realized people made radical changes in their lives to overcome. Of those 10, 3 of them are tangible: diet, lifestyle, and exercise. There's not one that works. They're all very individuated. The other 7... You are not allowed to say you treat cancer unless you are a board certified standard of care oncologist. I don't treat cancer. I don't teach my doctors how to treat cancer. We treat the terrain. The most influential impact on our immune system is what's happening in our microbiome.
You've said early detection isn't the same as prevention when it comes to cancer. Why is that?
Well, why is that is that the doctor is telling you this is going to improve your survival. But when push comes to shove, they won't tell you that unless you actively ask them. And then what they say is, well, geez, if the patient lives to 2 months, that's a win. This is a $1 trillion industry.
Oh, why do we keep saying they?
They are industry, specifically pharma and ag. The reality is that not a single patient I've ever been with before they take their last breath have ever said, I wish I'd worked more, I've accomplished this. I wish it comes always back down to.
Naysha, thank you and welcome to the Non-Toxic Living Podcast. You have an amazing journey. You were diagnosed with cancer when you were very young, stage 4.
Yeah.
So I want you to tell that story and then we'll get into the miracles you get to experience in this.
Yes. Oh, first of all, I love that you or even qualifying that. It's so beautiful. And Warren, it's so great to be with you. Like, it's, our paths have crossed many times over the years. And I just, when I don't ever know if I actually put it together of all that is you. So it's just an honor to be here. Like, talking before we started the recording, or maybe during the recording, you're just a beautiful person. When you meet up with people, other people, you bring that out of them too. So I just want to honor you in this conversation. I feel really excited to unravel this with you. But yeah, you're right. I had my own pain to purpose process. I was 19 years old. Leading up to that, I believe that I never was healthy. Like, literally came onto this planet unhealthy. I mean, like, the stories I get from my mom was, you know, you couldn't tolerate. In 1971, they weren't doing breast milk, right?
They weren't.
So, no.
1974, they weren't.
Yeah, like, nope, that's just too weird.
Yeah.
So they tried,
I wasn't breastfed either.
Yeah, and they tried every formula you can imagine. I reacted to all of them. So they finally just settled on the one that seemed to be the less reactive, which was soy formula, which that should probably right there say, oops, we started off on the, you know, took a wrong turn in Albuquerque at that time. And by the time I was 9, I was menstruating. By the time I was 11, I was on birth control pills for severe endometriosis. Mm-hmm. By the time I was 14, I was diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome, cervical dysplasia. By the time 16, it had advanced the cervical dysplasia. And I also got a lovely diagnosis of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis and IBS. And just like a collection. But here's the weird thing. I never saw them as diseases, nor did my mom or anybody else. They were just normalized, quickly given a script, and you move on. You just take these pills. You just do these drugs and you'll be fine. So it was normalized. So I never even thought of myself as sick because no one questioned. Like, you'll love this. My mom told me that the doctors told her that me pooping once a month when I was a baby was normal because it was just my journey, my pattern. So once a month, right? I worry about patients who do it once a day.
Twice a day.
Yeah, right. And so that was just to give that. So by the time I was 19, I'm a sophomore in college. In fact, this summer for my sophomore year in college, I started becoming more and more symptomatic and would show up in the emergency room because the pain was getting excruciating. Things were just not right. And I kept saying, something's not right.
Is that intuition?
Yeah.
And body's talking.
Yeah. But I was treated like a histrionic teenage drug-seeking female. Despite me saying, I'm wanting more drugs. They're not feeling good. They're not changing things. And it just was not being heard or seen until my roommate found me unconscious at home. And he somehow got me into the car and rushed me to the emergency room. I got a different doctor that night, a visiting ER doc, who took one look at me and realized I was not dealing with what they all kept saying I was dealing with. Did some proper examination, some proper labs, some proper imaging, and came in to tell me, through tears, extreme emotional, because he had a daughter my age, that I had some form of end-stage cancer. It would be a few weeks before we had the official diagnosis, but he suspected it was of ovarian origin, which turned out to be the case when I got the official diagnosis on October 21st, 1991. So yeah.
Now what?
Now what? Well, now what is that in the midst of that conversation, in the weeks leading, following that, I had 100% bowel blockage. So I could not eat. Even drinking small, even sips of water, I would throw it up and it would cause excruciating pain. So it was very difficult to even stay hydrated.
Did you actually have tumors?
Oh my God, a grapefruit-sized tumor in my right ovary.
Oh my gosh.
Tumors throughout my liver, tumors all throughout my pelvis, my what we call peritoneal implants. So basically like just stardust.
Tumors everywhere inside her.
Carcinomatosis, everything. I had fluid buildup in my abdomen known as malignant ascites. I had fluid buildup in my lungs, around my heart. I was in trouble. My oxygen levels were in the 70s because I had a complete...
You were like 2 weeks to...
Yeah. And they took me 3 months. Yeah. Like I think probably to sort of...
They love doing that.
Yeah, they like to kind of, you got about 3 months. And they said, there's nothing we can do. So get your affairs in order and we'll make you comfortable. And I'm 19, just 2 weeks shy, about 10 days shy of my 20th birthday at that time in 1991. And...
Were you in college?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just this moment. I was in college. I was in another state from where I grew up. And... I had this moment. Mm-hmm. I had this moment because the years leading up to this moment, there had been two occasions. My 16th year on this planet, my 17th year on this planet, I tried to leave this planet purposefully. And
understandably.
Yeah, yeah. And the family of origin, you have probably spoken about these scores, adverse childhood events, which are a questionnaire of 10 questions about experiences before the age of 18. And the more yeses or the more experience you've had, the higher incidence of chronic illness and cancer at a younger and younger age. So it should have come as no surprise as my medical brain self years later, looking back and saying, at a 10 out of 10, I had every possible extreme traumatic experience you could have as a young person that literally wired me differently, wired my nervous system, my hormonal system, my neuroendocrine system, and my immune system.
Which are all backed up by science now.
Exactly. Which in 1991, that was not much. So I'm sent home to die. I get another opinion. They send me home to die. And I'm realizing, because I'm at this point where at first I felt like, well, this is kind of a sexy way to go. It's a little more martyry and victim-y. A lot better than at my own hand. It will be less devastating to my friends and family if I go this way than dying, by suicide.
Yeah.
And so, but what happened is it was like, it was so flippant of, that one man having the very emotional piece, he then had to like shut down just to cope. Because in 1991, a 19-year-old with stage 4 ovarian cancer was not something you saw. Mm-mm. I mean, weirdly, flash forward today, one of the doctors.
Now I see it.
Unfortunately, I mean, one of the doctors who joined my training program a few years ago, head of gynecological oncology at a major academic institution, he and I started sharing some patients all under the age of 10 with stage 4 ovarian cancer. And that's when he was in his 70s, tried to retire and saying, I can't retire. It makes me emotional. He's like, I can't do it. Yeah. Why? How are we to this point? He'd been in his career for 40 some years. I've never seen these things.
We're chopping off limbs, cutting up ovaries.
Yeah. Just as a preventative. That's not prevention. And so here we are back at this time when they finally are telling me there's absolutely nothing you could do. And something about that lit a pilot light in me. Basically, when someone said it can't be done, I definitely have the gene, which I believe is, I'll just call it the double dog dare you gene, mm-hmm. because it was sort of like, if it can't be done, I was like, well, I'll show you.
Yeah.
I will.
No,
again. It's a... What'd you say? Yeah. I was ready to die, but you just said...
Yeah, hold my beer. I was kidding. Like that. Just diving in.
And so it was...
I mean, that's funny. Like, yeah. you were like, I'm going to go. I'm going to be a martyr. Like, it's nothing I can do. Everyone's telling me nothing I can do. And then and this is the power of words, right? It's a power of frequency. It's so many medical doctors were told that they were dumb. Uh-huh. Like me, I was told I was dumb growing up. I was told that, I wasn't in graduate school. And you were maybe at one of my events in Carlsbad where I was speaking. I don't know if you remember that, but I went in the room and I'm like, how many of you, raise your hand if you're, a medical doctor and successful. And I said, all of us in the room, I said, how many times someone told you that you weren't bright, that you weren't enough?
Yeah.
And then how many of you are now doing what you do because someone said that to you? I remember the people who said it to me.
Whew, got chills.
And that was my, you know, pullback resistance. It's pulling back on the resistance, and you're firing the arrow of your destiny. And that energy, that negative energy, is not hurting you. Yeah. It's actually setting you free. People think that when someone's yelling at you or giving you bad advice and telling you not enough, no, they're freaking loading the gun of your destiny, if you will. They're loading the bowstring. They're pulling back more on your purpose.
Yes.
And the more that's happening, don't be afraid of that. Yeah. Look where that energy is pointing you. Yeah. That's God's allowing it, if you will. The universe is allowing it for you to take it and go, or wake up. Because I didn't say that stuff. The universe does not, God does not say those words. He's never talking down to you,
no.
Right? So it's the opposite. So if someone's talking down to you, it's literally that you have a destiny and a purpose. So I love that it's consistent.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting. And it's funny.
It's the put down your beer, Gene. What did you, what did you say to me?
Yeah.
Excuse me. I got this. But you know, here's an interesting thing. So I talked about the years of just really the deep, deep, deep darkness of the soul. But part of that is I also lost all my faith because I grew up in a very, 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 very conservative religious state where teaching evolution was illegal in my school, in my education system.
You're going to hell if you're.
And all like those things. And then the very, very, very pious grandmother, you know, like just all that. Like I had a construct of religion that did not resonate with my soul.
Right.
It was very much based in like fear and loathing and judgment and
not grace and love. And
we're at the opposite because my essence was the grace, love and essence. That it may seem emotional to name this, but a few years back, my mom looked at me and she's like, I don't know where you find your joy from. And it just like hit me like a boomerang of, oh, I resourced that on my own. It's always been there. I accessed that on my own, despite everything and everyone around where I grew up going against that. Like you said, like the bow being pulled so tight. And I had an opportunity to believe.
Yeah.
At that time. And I was very, very sick. I don't ever wish that on anybody. But it was also all of the gifts that have come. And now it'll be 34 years, October 21st of 2025. The year that we are currently in having this conversation, that I was told there was no way.
No way.
There was no way. And that is what's led to my entire career. Because I will tell you, in the beginning, I kept this very, very secret. Very secret, because there was a lot of shame around it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of shame because there was a lot of trauma, a lot of abuse and things that I was not ready to let the outside world know. I had really protected myself and been like an overachiever to hide all of what was happening in my world, in my life. And so what the outside world was, they saw student body president and captain of the volleyball team and like a student and all the things, right? That was my compensatory mechanism to survive. And yet it was never enough. Right. And more never enough for myself.
Totally. Honey, yeah.
Yeah. And so in that moment, that's why when people, I can just imagine I'd taken my life at that time, I would have been so confused because I would have given no outward.
Yeah.
Like,
no one was sovereign. The sovereign. Yeah.
So I have such compassion when you see where people are in this place around this. Was like, you don't know what people are holding. You don't know what they're holding. And so for me, because of the environment I was in, because of the type of religious offerings in my world, I actually was very not atheist per se, but agnostic for sure. I kind of just felt rudderless in that arena. Some things kind of aligned that made me really come back and realize there is no way I would have been given all these things, been given all of those childhood traumas if there wasn't a purpose, a bigger purpose in this. And yeah, and I started really seeing that. And it really has been my North Star ever since. And the way I support myself, but also the way I support the patients that I serve. And, you know, I work with a very specific population. Cancer is about as far a way of connection, you know, as you can get, from organelle to organelle connection and to organelle to cell connection to cell connection and on, all the way from the micro to the macro. It is a complete lostness and disconnectedness and like the loss of signaling and the loss of communication and all the things that allow vulnerability so that certain conditions can take root. You were talking about sort of the Garden of Eden. I call this concept the terrain. Mm-hmm. You know, like the environment within us and around us is what allows us to be resilient from or sensitive to disease. Right. And so it's a constant, it's a dynamic you know, process, and that any time we can flip it back and forth between resilience and, you know, despair, I guess. Yeah.
Well, that is the true answer to medicine.
Yeah.
Right. So that is
finding that by an flex point.
Yeah.
It's really, really
so tight. There's something you talk about. I mean, so you said that cancer is not the enemy.
Yeah.
It's just telling it something.
Yeah.
What does it say?
Well, I mean, I do. Like, we've been waging the war on cancer since 1971, mm-hmm. since Nixon administration, when we set up the NCI, National Cancer Institute. It was like, it's an all-out war. And that made sense at the time. We were coming out of World War I, World War II, Korean War. We were still in the throes of the Vietnam War. There was like a global collective understanding of that concept. So I guess that metaphor made sense at the time.
Right.
But it's really not serving us any longer and hasn't been for a very long time because...
And we haven't won.
So that we're in fact
like,
we're not it's like a tons of
word
that's exactly it, or at the very least flatlined.
Yeah.
And so our overall survival rates since that waging war has basically remained flatlined all along. And the best we can do over a study that reviewed a collection of 96 medications that were rolled out into the oncology community over a 17-year period of time, that their overall survival rate on average of this collection of drugs in the cancer space was an overall survival rate of 2.4 months. And we call that winning victory.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
it is absolutely
it is mind boggling. And this is a $1 trillion industry now. And so I have doctors I've worked with when I have a patient, they're like, well, here, we're put them on this clinical trial and they're very excited. They talk the whole family into it. And I go through the absolute, statistics. Mm-hmm. And I show the patient, I show the family, hey, this is showing that it's going to give you 1.8 months more survival. Does that make sense to you?
Here's all the side effects.
Exactly.
And how you're going to feel for the extra
month. Yes, we call that informed consent. But the doctor is telling him, this is going to improve your survival. This is going to improve your survival. But when push comes to shove, they won't tell you that unless you actively ask them. And then what they say is, well, geez, if the patient lives to 2 months, that's a win. You know, Jeff wants me on that.
That's considered a survivor.
That is. And it's such a strange dynamic that we have settled for so little. We have set the bar lower and lower each decade since we waged war on cancer, and we've gotten virtually nowhere.
Yeah.
And we just come up with yet another sexier drug du jour that comes to market. And right now, the whole rage is in immune therapies, which fail patients over 80% of the time. Because they don't understand the immune system. They don't understand the individual. They don't understand how to support and prepare and modulate the immune system in the face of these medications. But that's where I come in and people that I train come in. We've been very well trained in how to get somebody ready for those drugs and how to support them. But we are up against somebody who's like, nope, you don't know better. We're going to make a success when this person lives 2.4 months beyond their, you know, diagnosis or their death sentence. And so this is the strange dance we've been in. So even all the way back and rewind, 1991, they were not, I mean, they're telling me in the end of September of 91 that I likely won't see 1992, right? Into 1992. So suddenly we're into 1992 and I'm still here. And it's like confusing because I was wanting to understand why, but I wasn't fighting and I wasn't doing anything. I was accidentally fasting because I couldn't eat. So didn't eat for 2.5 months, actually. And that resolved a lot of things in me.
Yeah, it chewed up all the tumors.
Yeah, it chewed up. So it debulked a lot of the tumors. It dried up the fluid. I had to get the fluid drained a lot in the beginning. And then it stopped coming back so quickly. And then I could go longer and longer between. And then my body was like, huh. Like I could start.
Hey, wait, I'm dead.
Yeah, yeah. And what else
can I do?
And then I go back to them and that's what I say. What else can I do? First of all, this is the weirdest thing. They were uninterested in talking to me. They were like, we don't have anything bad for you. I was also uninsured. So that was part of it. But they just did not know what to do with me because they still, by my labs and my imaging, I was too sick and too far gone. My kidneys had shut down. So they were afraid to give me any of the typical drugs for this. My liver really had. Yeah. So exactly. So now I can look back and go, well, that was also a blessing in disguise. But all of these pieces later, it's like no one knew what to do with me when I started to live. Frankly, I didn't know what to do with me. And so, like I said, fast forward all these years later, it wasn't until 2012 that I finally started to share my story a little bit. And even though I never, when I went to medical school, I was never.
So this will drive you to medical school?
It did.
Yeah.
It did.
So you waited till you got well or when?
No, which was crazy is I was still very, very sick.
And were you in medical school or pre-med when you?
Pre-med.
You're pre-med.
And, but I was pre-med to go to conventional medical school. Mm-hmm. That was what my training, I was looking at Baylor and that's where I was planning on going. Like all these pieces here were coming together. And I then had to hide my diagnosis, or this is my belief system at the time, because I had this fear that they would kick me out of school, right? That they wouldn't allow me to take classes.
They may have. Oh, why do we keep saying they? I always wonder. It's like, they. What is it? Like, I'm trying to think about it. Is it the opposite of God's energy? Is it the opposite of normal thought? Like, mm-hmm. What is they? Because when you look at, like, all the things you're saying are 100% true, right? There's nothing... And no one can argue this point if you're of sane mind. No, you can have psychological blots that don't you allow to receive this information because you have to protect your sanity. Yeah. Because when someone who's sacrificed their whole life to be a medical doctor and now has to believe that what you're saying is true, everything they're living is a lie, and your brain and your
dissonance.
Yes, you can't. Yeah. It's too hard. So and the whole thing, you know, this is why you don't judge. You never know what caused someone to be who they are, right? You never know. Like, there's so much sexual abuse, there's alcoholism, and you're seeing these manifestations of a behavior in an adult, and you're judging them, but you don't know where they came from, no matter what's happening in the world. So that goes off into like, but that's when you're alive, when you can feel. And that's the whole point of healing. That's the whole point of what you do. We talked about this off camera. It's love that's doing the healing, God that's doing it healing, and we're getting people reconnected to nature and to the synergy of how it makes us resilient. Because when you're in the sunshine, it's fire in your mitochondria. When you're on the ground, you're getting antioxidants and frequencies of healing, and it's lowering your risk of disease, and it's connecting you to energies and frequencies that heal your body, and it's getting you into parasympathetic where you can rest and digest and heal, and it gives you joy, you know. And we're living in this fake world with fake medications and synthetic everything, and we're supposed to thrive inside of that.
Yeah,
like, guys, if you're listening to this, stop. Yeah. Do what's right. Do what's in your gut, like you did.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You knew.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and even the main, I didn't. I just knew that they said there's something could be done. So I'm like, okay, I want to understand what's going on then. Right. And then my accidental fasting started to have some miraculous changes in my being that got me then curious to read. And so the first book I picked up after all of this, after everyone's saying you're done, you're dying, you're gone for, was a book in 1991, mind you, okay? A book by some guy, I couldn't even pronounce his name. I had no idea who this person was. No one did at the time, by a man by the name of Deepak Chopra. And a book.
Right.
And a book called Quantum Healing.
Yeah.
And I sat down on the floor in my little public library in a small mountain town in the fall of 1991, and I inhaled that book in 2 hours. And I literally sat there to have my own quantum healing. Because it spoke to all these components. It talked about this like people having a paradigm shift in an instant. And that's what happened for me. I was very like medically data scientific, pre-med in that role, very, you know, agnostic, atheistic, you know, in that zone as well. Like there's nothing more. It's very Newtonian, you know, or, you know, it's very black and white. That was
your energy is here, then your energy's gone.
Yeah. It was just like that was my world construct. It's really even hard to say that because it's so kind of think of my life before BC for cancer and AC, you know, like after cancer, because they really are completely different worlds. So the way I feel and experience the world and those around me, and I'm constantly in awe. It's like it's such a stretch to try to even remember. I mean, I'll be 54 here in a few days, and I never thought I'd see my 20, you know, be really deep into my 20th birthday. I definitely didn't ever expect to see 50th, right? And here we are into the 50th decade.
And you look great. Oh, you have energy.
We're talking about a little poison to come.
You're still communicating. You're still like I'm a little foggy in this toxic, you know, environment. There's so much mold. And I've had friends that are sick now and leaving. And I mean, I have an air filter running.
Yeah.
It's... We're doing this podcast, and like we did before, it was all like, hey, we're getting in the flow state. Exactly. I'm not worried about my brain. We're getting into quantum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo!
So was it quantum healing that was the
crux?
what really?
Well, it gave me so it started to give me a new construct.
Yeah.
It started to resonate with something that was just intuitive. Yeah. Just innate. Like, we are the expression of nature. You know, which for me, that is where I find God. That is where I can be with God, because to me, that is the most divine expression of God, and God's love is nature. And the world, you alluded to this, but today we are living as far away from nature, basically, as possible.
Yeah. And every decision in every area.
Yeah.
And that's the norm. And then you're a whack job.
Yeah. So
you're a country mom. That you see the movement, the regenerative farming people. Yeah. It's like, it's crazy.
Exactly. I mean, that's why
we're telling you, Zach, I thought he was crazy.
I know.
10 years ago. Yeah. And I'm like, Dr. Zach Bush, you should follow him.
Yeah.
I used to think he was a nut job. Yeah. I'm like, way too many mushroom journey if they were for that guy. Like, what the heck? And now I'm listening to him and going, wait a minute. The frequency of birds opens up the pores of trees so they can respire CO2 and oxygen. And I'm like, what? And this is a study?
Yeah.
Like, they have white shells. It's that symphony is that divine, that the bird's songs are necessary for trees to thrive and survive. And we think that we can drop glyphosate or urine. It's safe.
Yeah.
You know, do we think we can put a chemo drug into a soul and think that that's not going to affect the rest of humanity?
Yeah. We're going to poison someone back into health.
Yeah.
You know, especially at the level of the mitochondria, which is, you know, something that evolved from, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, potentially hundreds of thousands of years ago, based on some scientists' understanding. But that those little organelles, those little organs in our cells, you know, came from bacterium, and they make up upwards of 20% in some of us of our body composition. So there are significant.
Are we mostly bacteria? And
exactly, we're mostly bacteria anyway. We are far more bacterial cell, you know, than regular cells.
Yeah.
And so when we think about that, we think about when people like Dr. Don Cooper started to sound the alarm in the late 1960s of what he was seeing in a lab in the glyphosate, the Roundup world, started shouting out, going, guys, this is a problem. Like, this herbicide is going to change the planet as we know it if we move forward. And here we are. All these years later, first of all, Dr. Huber is still very much alive in his 90s. He is coming to our conference in a couple of weeks.
I'm
with speaking. You're going to have to. Zach Bush.
I just one of our humans. And a fly in, fly out.
You do. You know, Tucson's easy. And so we've got a whole entire panelist of regenerative farmers. That is just, you can't bring the farmer and you have to bring the farmers and the doctors.
No, the bacteria for regenerative farming. Yeah. We're
building a hospital on an organic, 1,200-acre organic regenerative farm.
Yeah, you are building an oncology
hospital. We're raising funds for that now.
And so you do use some medicines, right?
Absolutely. There's a type. But here's where. So these medicines, these chemotherapeutic agents, you know, many chemotherapeutic agents like taxane drugs come from the Pacific yew tree.
Yeah, they're right? From nature.
Vinco toxins come from periwinkle. There's most of our pharmacopoeia, 80% or better, come from nature. And then we've manipulated them in a lab so we can slack a patent on them and make them $1 billion, right?
And they're very inexpensive drugs to
make. Very inexpensive. Oh my goodness. And that's
so the margins, talk about ROAS. Is Matt return on ad spend, you know, or return on investment, ROI, you know, I mean, It's massive. Cost them a buck to make a vial, and they sell it for $1,000.
Sure. Yeah. And the crazy part, they're like, we're going to make this chemotherapy out of this herb, then we're going to patent that chemotherapy, and then we're going to completely discredit the herb.
Yeah.
We're going to completely say those people are quacks who use that herb, despite the fact that,
like, you've been told you're a quack for using mistletoe.
The oldest, most studied integrative oncology treatment in the world that is on the pharmacopoeia of every single country except for the United States. And in the United States, I had colleagues just last month who had their clinics raided in Ohio from the pharmaceutical board. Shame on you, Ohio Pharmacy Board, saying that these women were. So they made a big public hurrah out of it. And basically, make them a. And I'm saying that they were causing harm. This drug, this mistletoe extract, has been used consistently since 1917 in the same form that we use it in today. It is, if you have cancer and you live in Germany or Switzerland, 80% of cancer patients will use this at some point in their cancer care, and it's covered by their medical system. If you live in the rest of Europe, you have about a 40% chance of using this at some point. And some of the countries in the EU do cover it, but it's widely available. South America is the second largest user of this. The third largest user of this is Southeast Asia. The only, and Canada has a complete, you know, it's part of their drug, you know, pharmacopoeia as well. It is illegal in the United States, despite the fact that there are two Cochrane reviews, which is the highest level of validation, scientific rigor. It also has gone through a phase one clinical trial with pre-approval of phase two and three, funding pending for Mistletoe at Hopkins. We have a book that we wrote for clinicians as a resource and references to show all the data and the research behind this. And yet all that data given to the Ohio Pharmacy Board, they refused to even look at it.
And they're not bought.
One of the doctors was, had to pay a $100,000 fine. And she said, I'm going to pay the fine and I'm going to keep giving this to my patients because this helps. And the crazy thing is you don't use it instead of, you use it with standard of care because it potentiates the standard of care. It protects the bone marrow. It protects the organs of elimination. It protects the psychology of the patient. It creates extreme quality of life. It lowers the fatigue. There are literally thousands of studies of this plant for decades. And yet in this country, it's illegal. We use it as an off-label so we can get by of it. And so Ohio is the first state that has now come actively against some of our doctors using this, but we will fight that. We will overcome that because that is darkness. Yeah. That is not light in action. That is not protecting anybody but the interests of pharma. Yeah. And they, when I see things like this happening, that tells me that we are touching a nerve. They are industry, specifically pharma and ag, big pharma, big ag. Those are the two biggest monsters driving it.
They can scare the junk out of you if you're not in a lawsuit.
Absolutely. I mean, too. That's what happened to these two doctors. They bullied them into this, but both of them are still persevering. And that's where it's like, this is what
we're so like, what did like, I don't know if you realize how strong someone has to be, how much love you have to have for humanity to fight against someone that's literally taking out your lifestyle.
Yeah.
Like you could lose everything, like everything, your home, you know, the friends, like you're labeled and this is why you have to be connected.
Big time. Both these women are. And both of these women, their patients are coming to bat. Our community of doctors that I train are coming to bat. Our organizations around us, like the compounding pharmacists and the people who put the Mistletoe manufacturers in Europe, the other pharmacy boards, even people from the Health and Human Services committees are all rallying. This will not stop us. In fact, it's only... It's the double dog dare gene is there activated.
We have put down our case of beer.
Because it's a bunch of us.
We're
like a West Side Story moment.
You're not rolling over. You're going for it. And in this space, you know, so many times, like someone told me, like Dr. Buttar potentially was poisoned, and like who knows? Like it's, you know, you can say that this is the level of like folks. If you're listening to this, this is your. The box has been opened.
Yeah.
There's nothing. Oh my gosh. Like, I didn't know. Like, I know it's bad, but then when you get into the cancer area,
because it really,
there's so much profit there. Yeah. And if you mention that word.
Yeah.
And right.
We're not allowed. So, unless you are not allowed to say you treat cancer unless you're a board certified standard of care oncologist or a board certified dental surgeon. So, I want to be really clear for you and your listeners, I don't treat cancer. I don't teach my doctors how to treat cancer. We treat the terrain. We treat the environment in which the cancer expressed. That's all. And when we do that, what we're doing is we're returning the body and the being and the soul back to its highest good, back to its this beautiful orchestra that you described earlier that it was just meant to be. It's like, why is it that when I left medical school, I think it was first of all, at the turn of the century, it was the 1900s, it was 1 in 200 we had cancer rates. By the time I started practice, it had gone up to 1 in 8. That was a big jump in a short period of time. But that's post-industrial food revolution. That's post-World War II, where we took all the leftover ammo and invested it into Big Ag and Big Pharma, and everything changed. That's before we started bringing plastics, hormones, like the way we process our food, the 80,000 plus chemicals that have not been tested, massive amounts of sugar, especially highly processed sugar and ultra-processed foods, glyphosate, COVID vaccines, microRNA and injections, because they're not vaccines. Like, these are the types of things that have been brought to our world that did not exist a generation or two ago. And so now to watch it coming up, up, up the step of 1 in 200 to 1 in 8, you're like, ooh, I could see that. But it's now 1 in 2. It is a flip of a coin that you will meet a diagnosis of cancer in your lifetime.
And when you treat the terrain, from what I know of your work, you get just some miraculous. Yeah. The body is miraculous.
Yeah, yeah. And so we all enter cancer an average of 7 to 10 times a year is what's the theory. That's what's theorized out there, that we kind of go in and out of it, but our bodies do an amazing job surveilling, you know, so recognizing, responding, and remembering to know what to do. So that's your immune system, right? But when that gets dismantled because of various changes in things like your microbiome, probably the most influential impact on our immune system is what's happening in our microbiome. Now, coming back to the fact that we rolled out, remember that we're mitochondria, you know, very heavily mitochondria rich, which were bacteria inside of us. So thinking bacteria, we rolled out a particular big pharma product to, you know, kill weeds, but also quick ripening.
The old shikimate.
Shikimate pathway, guys. What then has happened is you've basically brought on a massive antibiotic to Mother Earth.
Yeah, it is.
It is a massive.
It's patented as an antibiotic. Yeah.
So when you think about that, Joe, we'll just think about, at least, you know, knowing that we're mostly bacteria, how do you, like, just intuitively, instinctively, common sense should tell you, does it seem like a good idea that we are all consuming, whether we know it or not, massive amounts of antibiotics on a daily basis? Air, water, soil.
It's in everything.
It's in our rain.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're...
Then it's wiping out our soil, which is what Zach Bush talked about.
Exactly.
And not that bacteria, which is what the plants need, the bugs need to
create
interconnection.
Yeah.
That, like, and so you can't, without bacteria, we can't chew on CO2. Without the bacteria, we can't break down the minerals in the soil to put it back in the plants that work with the nematodes and the symphony, once again, the terrain.
Exactly.
We are the terrain.
We are. We are an extension. There is no difference of what's happening in us to what's happening on our planet. And if you don't, this is the thing, is a lot of people are like, well, I'm not going to go and learn environmental medicine, or who cares about regen ag, or what, you know, people get super excited about whatever niche they're in. But you cannot heal a body if you do not heal the planet, the plants, the animals. And
it's all interconnected.
It's all interconnected. And that's what we've done. Descartes started us off on this journey of separation and polarization and, you know, sort of funnel vision on it all, that we're coming full circle to expand it back to what the indigenous peoples have been telling us all along, right? That we are of nature, and that we are, and it is our true nature to be vital. And so that's the place that I think is happening around the globe right now that's different. I mean, I've been saying these things for 30 some years as a naturopath, but then I was perceived as the weird quacko, you know, saying these things. The sciences are catching up. People in the planet, the patients are waking up. They are demanding a different paradigm.
It's here. It really is. So that's the exciting thing. I thought, you know, Zach was a little 15 years ago, a little wacky, you know, but now I'm like, that son of a bitch goes there.
I know, right?
But I used to think he was a whack job. I was just not listening. I wasn't seeing. And the world is listening and seeing now. And even guys like me, all sciencey, 50 years old, just turned 50. What's the life all about? You know, is it really this endless cycle of striving for lies? It's all a lie.
Zap talks about this as well. But, you know, when you work with cancer, you will inevitably be around death as well. Like, it's just, it is a life cycle. We're all going to meet that someday. It's just that some people, you know, it depends on, you know, when, where, how, when, but none of us know, right? We can't tell someone, you're going to be gone. And, you know, like, even those stories get put out here. But the reality is that not a single patient I've ever been with in the last, you know, months, weeks, days, moments before they take their last breath have ever said, I wish I'd worked more, I've accomplished this. I wish it comes always back down to love.
Always.
Always. I had never, you know, and I want to take it back on two occasions. Challenging deaths to be witness to and to be part of were folks who were really stuck in resisting love. Mm-hmm. And you know, they were hard deaths to witness. They were really hard deaths to witness, and they weren't ready, which made it even harder. I mean, no one's ever ready per se, but there's this place that happens. You see that shift when someone realizes, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going everywhere. Like, there was just this, like...
I'd been around people, and a few people, and you've been around many, yeah. But I literally, the energy, I start weeping. I'm like, there's so much love in this room. And I didn't know what it was back, you know, this is again 10, 15 years ago. I'm like, why am I crying? What is on you? Like, what is this? You know, I mean, it's God, right? It's like there's a connection between heaven and earth in their body as they're transitioning.
And we get a witness. We get to bear witness about Simon.
Crazy. It's almost like it's like a loving conviction. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. I'm missing out. Like,
yeah,
I'm missing out on something here.
If you're not paying attention, you'll miss it.
And then in all of our striving and all of our sympathetic, yeah, we're numb to it. And that's why breath work.
Or afraid of it.
Yeah. Or afraid of it. Because, yeah, you know, yeah, you are afraid. Like when I, yeah, it is scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then when you say yes to the love, everything does change. And it's, you know, it's esoteric. It's kind of like yeah, if someone's listening to this, it's like, what the hell are you talking about? Are you off on some other planet? I'm like, such once was I. You know, I used to judge. And thank you. You're judging me. That's fine. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm okay with that because I did it too.
Yeah.
Right. But there is this frequency of love that when you tap into it, it does the healing.
Yeah. You know, you make me think of I used to host cancer retreats. And so in those, my husband, my sister-in-law and I would host these cancer retreats. So we would take women. At that time, they were just women, and we would, and then they expanded over time. But we would just take women. We'd gather them on a Friday evening, 4 p.m. And we finish up at 10 a.m. on a Monday morning. We would do labs before we'd all get together for these weekends, and then we do labs a week after. So we could see the objective changes as well as the subjective changes, as well as turn it into like an educational experiential process, which is what actually led to my book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. So what I would teach in that 4 day or 2.5 day experience was basically the blueprint for what became The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. But what was really interesting is I got to see in real time what I call my version of the CBC, which is circadian rhythm. We would get everyone really reconnected, understand like, where are we in the cycle of the moon? Where are we in the cycle of the seasons? Where are we in the cycle of your life? Where are we in the cycle of maybe your menses or no longer menses, or wherever you are in the sort of the season of your femininity? You know, all of those pieces we'd connect there. We'd also make sure that the lighting was right and how we were exposing ourselves to the lighting, and we had blackout curtains, and we were educating, like empowering them about how to harness light, you know, and use it when, why, and where. And then diet, we would have show them how to eat locally, seasonally, regionally, organically, you know, as clean and as close to nature and as close to its original source as possible. And specific to my population, it's always wise to carb restrict everybody, because that's an extra lever you can utilize to help potentiate other therapies. So we would have them on a very low carbohydrate diet. And then we also practice a little bit of intermittent fasting. So that was the part of the diet piece. But also sharing, like breaking bread together. Of course, we weren't breaking bread, but kind of like being together in these places. And then the finals, these community. And that's where the magic was, is these. But these, we could have just sat there and done nothing, and we would have seen extreme healing happen, because it was people on a journey that seemed so insurmountable and so frightening, like tapping into that parasympathetic together, the oxytocin together. And so we're like, here's the real CDC. This is what you're going to take home from this weekend. So one of these weekends, I don't know, I probably done maybe a dozen or so of these gatherings. And we were in circle, and we were all kind of going around what we were grateful for. And just the day before that gathering, I literally held in my arms like a baby one of my patients as she took her last breath. And it was divine. Like, she prepared for her dying in such a way that, like, goals, right? Like, she was so beautiful how she prepared for this and how she set it up in such reverence. It was the most beautiful and healing experience ever. It was so gentle and powerful. And I was just reflecting on that in the circle, and a lot of the women in this group knew her or knew of her. And so I was speaking to her, but it just hit me in that moment that in the early part of my career, I thought I wanted to be a midwife. And I delivered 36 babies. And I realized, oh my gosh, this is such an incredible experience, but I will never sleep again. And I sleep is how I repair. And it was like realizing that this is something I really love to do, but it will cause me harm in the short and long term. And so I stepped away from that. And in that moment that I was there with this circle, and I reflected on Maria Gabriel, I realized that at that moment, her death was the 36th death I had been part of. And I realized in that moment,
when you were holding her baby,
I was holding her. She was like a baby in my arms, and Edshun left this planet and left this plane. And I realized in that moment that the portal, the doorway, is exactly the same. You share the same doorway of entering this world and exiting this world, and that it is just as beautiful and just as terrifying and just as like scary, you know, but also there's so much love. Like, it was just that moment. And it did something for me. This is probably back in 2013, I believe. It shook something free in me that just really changed my perspective of death and dying.
Yeah.
In a way that I thought I had done a lot of work around that, especially my own. And suddenly I was like, this is the same doorway. We all get to walk through it twice, you know?
And so simple and so beautiful.
So beautiful.
But it's not the how we process it right now, isn't that?
We do everything, especially in my population and people I serve. So many people are so afraid of dying that they are not living. And that could be true for anything beyond cancer as well. But if you definitely are facing your mortality in some situation, that can be so overwhelming to the nervous system and so putting into that system overdrive. This is, you know, there's no way, no matter how good the treatment is, no matter how good the standard of care or the alternative or the integrative or how good the spiritual practice or how good the diet or the lifestyle or whatever, if they are still living in fear, fear is the antidote to love. Love is the antidote to fear. They can't coexist. That one has to push out the other. It's a strange dynamic. So,
and I've experienced
it. Yeah.
Like, so if I'm worried about life, like worried about like my children and my family, or being the father that I want to be, or worried about my wife being upset with me because I'm disconnected today, or worried about finances, yeah. Every time I get connected to my parasympathetic, mm-hmm. I come out of that, yes. Zero fear. Zero, like zero worry. Yeah. And I'm like, it's all going to be okay.
Yeah.
So one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself is getting into your parasympathetic.
Absolutely.
Getting connected to the frequency of love in your life that's surrounding all of us. This portal, if you will, is open to us all.
Yeah.
And it sounds wacky, but I get it finally, you know, and it's really special. And we get to share it boldly. Like, if I'm going to share anything, that's the message I'm going to share. That's what I'm going to be known for. You know, I mean, I feel like the three. I feel like I'm in the 60s without all the sex. So three Costco swaps, you know, three toxins at Costco that I wouldn't ever, you know, as an environmental scientist, you know, so all this stuff, it's little simple things. But ultimately, it's little tiny expressions of love that I can share with people to let them get connected to that portal, to let them choose love for themselves. Eat something that's actually going to be good for you. Don't live the lie of the fake.
Right.
Don't live the lie of the fear that you don't have enough money, so you have to buy the junk food.
Right.
It doesn't work.
No.
It's the opposite. It's going to give you. It's going to give you less money. It's going to give you more fear. It's going to give you sickness. It's going to give you disease.
Yeah.
So when you're choosing these things and you're getting mad at me, mm-hmm. like, or upset, no, it's, you're choosing love for yourself. You're choosing nature. And you're getting, these are little baby steps.
Yeah.
You know, buying organic pitted dates at Costco versus the dull corn syrup, you know, glyphosate laden, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like, that's one step closer to nature. You're moving closer to the portal. You're moving closer to God.
Yeah. And that's, each step makes a huge difference, no matter how seemingly small or insignificant.
Yes.
And it's just going back, remembering where we actually came from. And remembering what is actually normal. Joel Salatin is someone that I adore in the regenerative farming world. He's known as the lunatic farmer. He has a...
I would like to meet him.
Oh, but you have to meet him. He is... First,
let me guess, he's going to be at the event.
He's not busy speaking at another, but he's been on my podcast, yeah. The Metabolic Matters. So you should go have a listen. He also wrote a book years ago, which is what I'd heard from about him in other places. But this book really spoke to me. It's called Folks, This Ain't Normal. And it talks about how we have normalized everything. And this is years ago before it's even as wacky doodle as it is today. And I actually had a chance, a very intimate group with about 12 of us got to tour his Polyface Farms out in Virginia in July. And to see this man who, since 1962, has been a steward of this land that has never once had any chemical input, that he has been shut down. Like, he has, my husband, I got a t-shirt from there that says, everything I want to do is illegal. Mm-hmm. That's what I got from Polyface Farm. So things like raw milk, grass-fed and grass-finished cattle, you know, it's illegal, wild foraging pigs, like, yeah. You know, chickens that aren't being bleached and things like that. So I laugh that that's what he's like, everything I want to do is illegal. So I love that.
Unbleached chicken, it's illegal because you're going to die.
You're not dipping it in the borax, right? It's like, oh. So he is just incredible. And he came from his parents and he grew up in somewhere in South America, farmsteading until the government overthrew that area and he had to return to the U.S. and they acquired this piece of property. He's in his family farmed ever since. That has never changed. So most regenerative farmers in this country have either learned or cycled through his property to learn these skills. And walking around watching how much he can produce, he can produce like 64,000 chickens there a year. They get harvested for the cleanest possible chicken meat you can find. And we got to go and see how they are at as close to nature as it gets. Like, you know, these types of things, like there's
like wild
distress, kind of like really, it's just this crazy process. So watching his whole operation and people saying you have to do it on these massive scales to feed the world, it's simply not true.
It's another lie.
It's a lie. And it's a lie.
We have to do big farming to save the planet and you pulling on our heartstrings.
Right.
Yeah, we have to agree with factory farming because otherwise we can't feed the planet.
Right.
There's no, we have to do it.
Yeah.
We have to because everyone's going to die.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, we had grain sitting in silos with mold and mycotoxins on it.
Right.
And then we may give that to somebody.
Well,
and then
we do the animals that them get sick and then we ingest them.
Laden with toxins because the food's not being eaten and harvested. It's rotting. Bacteria is once again.
Exactly. Not the right bacteria. Like it's
mold. Yeah.
Exactly. And so this is the world we normalized the abnormal to such a degree
that and you're feeling, and you're made to feel guilty.
Yeah.
Yeah, to think differently.
Yeah, you question.
You're hurting humanity.
You are deplatformed. You are put. You know, you get on. So when someone told me a few years back, maybe 10 years ago, they're like, "Do you know you're on Quack Watch?" And at first, I was like, and then I thought, "Oh my God, I've made it."
Yeah, you make it real fun.
That means I'm actually doing.
Is that guy even still around?
He is
still around.
Really? I keep waiting for his epiphany. I keep waiting for his wake up. You know, and I just keep sending him love and light because. It makes me sad that he doesn't, first of all, I can't imagine living in that world, that belief system.
Yeah, it's really hard.
You know, we started kind of the conversation about miracles. I remember a medical conference, a big, huge cancer conference, conventional cancer conference, and I'm in the back of the room standing, more observing, because I'm definitely not telling people I'm a naturopathic oncologist in this space. Like, it is super buttoned up. You know, standard care oncology. And I see this oncologist asking, how many of you in this room have stage 4 cancer patients? And every single person in the room raised their hand. He goes, how many of you seen any of those cancer patients go into remission?
Like, did you break your hand?
No, I just sat there taking it in because I thought, you know, the stones will come. No, this is like 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago. No one raised their hand. And I'm looking around the room going, I get to see these every day. So it would be hit me in that moment. They don't get to see the miracles I get to see every day. Or if they happen, like what happened with me, they don't want to hear about it. So years later, when people were
should break down their paradigm and break down their security, breaks down the whole like purpose.
Talking to my colleagues, my conventional oncology friends, like, why do you think this is? With this room, like I just realized in that moment that I get to see miracles every day, and partially because I expect them. I also look for them. These guys, A, don't expect them and definitely don't look for them. And if they are sitting there right on their lap and right in their face, they wouldn't recognize them if they bit off the tip.
They'd be like, oh, just spontaneous formation.
Right. Yeah. Which people like my friend, Dr. Elia Turner, her book, Radical Remission, she went and studied 10,000 of these spontaneous remissions and realized there's nothing spontaneous about them at all. They're radical. People made radical changes in their lives to overcome. Of those 10, three of them are tangible: diet, lifestyle, and exercise, right? And there's not one that works. They're all very individuated. The other seven are the inner work, the spiritual work, the emotional work, the mental emotional healing process, the trauma resolution, the service and connection to others. That's where it is. That is what is mostly left off the table in our standard of care environments for the most part. Yeah.
I hope people are getting it. I think they are getting it. You've said early detection isn't the same as prevention when it comes to cancer. Why is that?
Well, why is that is that things have to be big enough and loud enough to even detect them at an early stage. And so if you're just waiting until something shows up, you're too late. Like, it's already active and on the move. And so true prevention is about evaluating the whole terrain. Not looking for cancer, but looking for things that could contribute to cancer and start to make those changes long before. Like, I tell folks, focus on the ember smoldering in the basement of your being versus, you know, waiting until it's a building engulfed in flames, which even early detection is too late.
What cancer patient's story gives you the chills when you think about it?
Oh, man. Probably the woman who put me on the cancer stage again. I was so, even though I was seeing a lot of cancer patients in my tiny town of Durango, Colorado, kind of like, oh, please don't make me do this again. But this woman came in rolling in a wheelchair, coming in for end of life care, stage 4 ovarian cancer. Just wanted comfort on the way out. And we were working on that. That was how we were approaching it. There was no expectation. And I, of course, nobody knew about my story and my history. And in supporting her, fast forward, that was in about 2011, maybe 2010, 2011. Fast forward, Kate's still waiting to get this book out there into the world. But she's also who gave me the courage to tell my own story in all of this. But within a matter of weeks, just helping her face her mortality, make her comfortable in doing so, start to assess her terrain and help her address some things that she was unaware of physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, she started to stabilize. And then she was getting out of that wheelchair, and then she was actually getting better, and then her hair was actually growing back, and then she was actually able to tolerate some more chemotherapy, but with a different approach with it, with therapy, with our therapies, so that it wasn't as intolerable. And slowly but surely, she was in a small Inspire was the name of this online support group for cancer patients. She was in an ovarian cancer group, and she started to share her story. And it was this woman who single-handedly put her story on the planet that brought me out of the closet of my story, that brought an entire movement of women together. There's 24,000 women at that time diagnosed with cancer, ovarian cancer, per year, with over 17,000 of those dying in that same year. And so they were a small and scrappy bunch that were looking for answers. And she rallied the troops in, and she changed her life. She changed my life, and she's still changing lives.
It's amazing. These stories,
thousands of stories like her that I've had. The absolute.
But you're on Wired Watch.
Oh, yeah.
Andrew probably called a quack for using
Melody on. And I'm, you know, she's not a real doctor, despite the fact that my education was no different than standard of care. I had to train in the exact same modalities and tools. I actually learned more pharmacology than my conventional colleagues, because I had to understand the interactions between herbs, supplements, nutrients, and other drugs. I had to I got like 1,000 hours of education in nutrition that they got 0 in most cases, or a couple of hours in some cases. I mean, our biochemistry training is more extensive, our pharmacology training more extensive. Where we differ is our philosophy. That's all. We see the body as having the wisdom to heal, and they see it as something to conquer.
We, again, have to use something outside of nature to fix.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what's the number one lifestyle factor that fuels cancer growth?
Oh, wow. Boy, that's a big one. And I think sitting with that for just a moment, I think it's denying your own truth. And I think that sounds very esoteric, but there is a common denominator with patients with cancer. We've done some research actually in the mental emotional realm, and we did a hundreds of patient study to kind of look for certain patterns.
Right.
And the big 70% of all these patients that we studied in these hundreds of patients, and the most common denominator for them was not being seen and heard. And so that place of just not belonging and not being worthy is really a toxic cesspool to live in and to function from, and to help people understand their own, they are just as important. They have every right to completely be here and thrive here as anybody else, and to be seen and heard, and to bring their gifts to the world, whatever those may be. That's really powerful. You know, instead of putting themselves last, they can start to eat themselves up to actually step into what they truly came here to do, into their true purpose. So I always ask my patients, what brings you joy?
Mm-hmm.
For what are you grateful? And what did you come here to do? And if they can't answer those easily, they have a poor prognosis.
Yeah.
And so to me, that is one of the most underserved. We're always kind of looking for the thing, the outside of us thing. But that's the inside job that makes the biggest difference.
I mean, coaching practitioners for so long and dealing with seeing the pattern, like I used the pattern. If the number one challenge these practitioners had is getting their patients to love themselves and to choose themselves and to deal with the trauma. Because every single time, if they didn't do that, they weren't able to do the diets and do the things.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, and let's take you a step further. If the patients aren't doing that, as I've had doctors over the years ask me about, why have you such good compliance with your patients on these diet or these lifestyle modifications compared to me? I'm like, are you doing your own work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, are you able to give energy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, are you stepping into your own stuff so that you can show up for yourself first, the oxygen mask, concept, so you can better serve others. You know, none of us are perfect all the time, but if you're not actively seeking to improve your own vitality, your own resilience, your own spiritual, richness, how can you expect somebody else to step to do the same?
You're incongruent.
Exactly.
It's like talking about non-toxic things and drinking a diet.
Yeah, it's like you're talking over that plastic. Okay, I need you to do X, Y, Z. And I'll just be back here while you're...
Pull on those wee lemons,
Oh, God. Put it over the vajayjay.
Yeah.
Again, wonder why you've got these issues going on later.
Yeah.
If someone had a cancer diagnosis today, what would you tell them to do tonight?
Oh, first of all, I'd tell them to pause and breathe. Because in 1991, when I was diagnosed, I didn't have Dr. Google. I didn't have influencers. I didn't have thousands of books. There were dozens and dozens of clinics all over, the United States that I could go to help me. I had to resource for myself, mostly internally at that time. And so I think in some ways, if I was diagnosed with that same diagnosis today, I think it'd be much harder because now we have so much input, so much well-meaning, but truly wrongful advice being thrown at someone. The options are overwhelming.
Yeah.
And so that pause and that breath and getting very centered and very quiet and still and listening deeply to yourself and just getting a baseline is really, really critical. And so in that moment, before you react, you need to sit still to prepare to respond. So the way we meet our diagnosis is actually our prognosis. And so Lawrence Lashan, a famous researcher, wrote a book called Cancer as a Turning Point. And, these patients, the way they respond to that diagnosis is prognostic, in that if you stay in that reactivity, like, I got to do this, I got to get paid right now, I got to do this, and I bought all these, you actually have worse outcomes than those who say, I'm going to take a breath. I'm going to look at the landscape. I'm going to choose two or three really good evaluations and opinions. I'm going to do a little research outside of the standard of care as well to see what I could do to optimize all of this process. And then I'm going to gather data. I'm going to gather tests. I'm going to test and assess before I address. I'm not going to guess. And I'm going to be very thoughtful and intentional, precise and personalized. Those patients have extraordinary outcomes. The reactive jump in, do everything, go to a million different people, get a million different pieces of advice. They're an effing mess.
Yeah.
They're in such sympathetic overdrive. It doesn't matter how well curated my therapeutic recommendations are, they will never land. Yeah. They were never landing.
When has reacting an emotion ever won for you in life?
Never.
Never.
Always plubs up. Or at least fizzles out. Yeah.
And when have you sat back and allowed that intuition and taken time and slept on it?
Yeah.
Has your life been better? So that's really all you're saying is sleep on it for a few days. Yeah. Make thoughtful, parasympathetic decisions, not out of fight or flight. Yeah. Even if it's natural, like, oh, I'm going to run to keto. Yeah. Keto's going to fix me. Yeah. I'm going to run fasting. I'm going to keep, I'm going to do this. I'm going to run to the vegan diet. I'm going to run to this. All these influencers, right?
And they all have some great information and parts to play.
Yeah.
But take a breath.
Yeah.
Take in some love.
Take in some love. And then take in some, gather some information. Be a detective before, so you really can plot your map thoughtfully. And I want folks to remember, it's super rare that a diagnosis of cancer is an acute emergency. It's very rare that it's like taking up such valuable real estate that it's causing some potential dangerous harm to the body. Like, that is so rare. It happens.
Yeah.
Super rare. Most of the time, this has been something that's been brewing within you for an average of 7 to 10 years is what the research shows. So is there a medical emergency for you to deal with it in the next, 7 to 10 days or 2 days? No. Take the time to gather the information and choose your path wisely.
I love it. Be your own doctor.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's the smartest one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Aisha, thank you. It's been an honor and privilege. Lovely. I'll see you in a couple weeks.
We'll see you soon, my dear. I love her. Bringing you to the desert, to Tucson. Yeah. I'm hanging out with the farmers and the doctors all in one place.
All the people I used to judge.
And now you'll give the kumbaya.
So yeah, it'll be beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. What an honor. Yeah.